title?
It's, the title is Liberty and Grace in the Divine Comedy. So it's in Dante and Augustine, but it's really in Dante who is engaged in a kind of imaginary dialogue with Augustine, with ideas that he has been gathering from. My paper today will focus primarily on what I take to be Dante's vision of a new culture, the foundation of which is laid out in Purgatorio's central theme. That's the liberty. That's the, and later in Paradise with the complementary question of grace. So there are two different canticles that I'll be looking at. The concern with liberty is not really an absolutely new orientation of thought. In fact, it was shaped by St. Augustine's perspective. He put forth in works such as On Free Will, On Grace, Creation, etc. The two of them, since this is the general background to my thinking, the two of them, Augustine and Dante, as is known, live just about 1,000 years apart from each other. But taken together, they shaped the historical discourse of our culture. And I mean theological, political, moral, literary, aesthetic, and so on. It is only too well known that in their writings, they were drawn to similar projects, such as engaging in autobiographical works, in political, moral explorations of historical subjects, such as the earthly city, Rome, moral explorations of historical subjects, such as the history of Rome, Rome's apotheosis of power, and the insight into liberty, which is, I hope, to show, such as the questions that connects with many others. That's why liberty seems to be so crucial for them. It's always an issue, liberty, as we heard a little earlier here, connected with many others, laws, individuality, the psychological aspects of experiences, theology, and it also opens up new perspectives. Liberty is an absolutely crucial issue with them because they understand the implications and consequences of it. The turning point in Dante's thought about the need for a new culture, back to the, as it's really takes place really at the beginning of Purgatorio. But the real reason lies a little bit ahead of it, so as to say, in hell, in inferno, which is the first part of the poem. What triggers this emphasis on freedom is the horror, actually. Freedom in purgatory, he talks about, now, this is all he talks about as a theme of the poem. What triggers this question, no doubt, is the horror he witnessed throughout Inferno, the emblem of which is the spectacle of dissolution of what the poem seeks to recover. Inferno dissolves the main concern of the poem, the human quest for the divine, and the hope on God's grace, that the God continues to grant his grace to human beings. This is the paradise. But Inferno, all this disappears, and Purgatorio rethinks this question. In Inferno 33, let me just show you what I mean, why Inferno is really the background to the argument on liberty. The path to God is not at all visible, and it is replaced by an unprecedented, tragic sequence, the drama of cannibalism between two political enemies, namely Ugolino, who is accused of being treacherous, a traitor to political cases, wealth and the Ghibelline, and so on, as most people are aware. And Ugolino is shown in Canto 33 of Inferno, chewing at the head of his archenemy, the Bishop Ruggiero. In addition, everything that appears in the unfolding of this canto, such as Ugolino retells a dream he had overnight, suggests the reduction of the human being to the state of wild animals. He keeps thinking of wolves and himself as a wolf running away from other wolves. Everything that appears, my sight is not very good, so I'll make everything that appears here comes around being the desecration of the human, who are all these human beings who have been put in the Tower of Hunger, where Ugolino, this is the man with the dreams, and his innocent children are shut so that they can starve to death. The cannibalism ensues, this kind of punishment that actually gets realized. More than that, driven by natural appetite, hunger, he yields to hunger, he says, more than grief, and cannibalizes his own dead children. This is the background. The scene, deliberate echoing, actually, there are echoes, verbal echoes of Christ's sacrificial death on the cross, and his and the echo marks the distance or loss of memory of the Redeemer's sacrifice meant to put an end to history's violence. And of course, the poem shows that that sacrifice may have been a failure because the violence is perpetuated, it seems. The canto 33 and 34 opens, therefore, 33 for the reasons I just described, but also 34, opens for Dante a vital challenge. This is the reason why he thinks about how to remake the world in purgatory. How can the human community be reconstituted after seeing this horror, this hideousness of Canto 33 and Canto 34? Canto 34, we have the site of, it's truly a satanic canto, where Satan, extending the metaphor of cannibalizing, has three heads in an overt parody of the Trinity, and he holds in his three mouths the so-called the killers of Caesar, Cassius and Brutus being two of them. So the series of infernal cantos then culminates with a hideous picture in 34, where we watch a somewhat parallel scene as in Canto 33. Two Romans, Brutus and Cassius, murderers of Caesar, and Judas being the third one, who betrayed Christ, one placed in Satan's three mouths, each one of them placed in one of the three mouths of Satan, simultaneously political and theological figuration, but seen in a dark light. As Dante the Pilgrim, guided by Virgil, reaches the southern hemisphere, Purgatory is on an island which is in the southern hemisphere. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, the universe, the world was divided between the map, the northern hemisphere, which is where we all are, and then the southern hemisphere, which is now the beautiful part, the beautiful weather, and that's where the island of Purgatory is found. Dante wants to leave hell behind in every sense of the expression. He knows the daunting, greatest possible challenge now he must face. What is the way leading to the moral, practical reconstruction of the human community? This is the essential point that Purgatorio goes on figuring, presenting. This is the real issue of that part of the poem. The dawn of Easter Sunday the day when this Purgatorio, the canticle, opens. That is to say, the day Dante and Virgil reach the shore of Purgatorio is the feast which the liturgy of the Church, as all of you know better than I, celebrates as the event of a new creation and a new beginning for mankind. So it's very appropriate that this is where Dante wants to present this possibility of a new creation of the world. Let me make the point clear. The view of a new beginning, the idea of, and the idea itself of the word, the adjective new, is indispensable to the thought of liberty. Every time we think about something new, it means that we are ready and willing to break away with things from the past, the new, usher in something unknown. So the thought of liberty and the new history, away from the horrors of the Civil War, the horrors of treachery, the horrors of destructive passions. The question now hovers over Dante. How can human beings remake themselves? What kind of human wisdom and ethical tradition can they rely on? In the distance, just to tell you how Dante prepares, and you go and read the poem, probably will appreciate it a little bit more because of this Mark's hope. In the distance, Dante sees the dim light of four stars. This is how he prepares the whole scenery. It's Easter Sunday. The world, that's what the Church tells us, that's what the event means. The world experiences a new creation. But Dante goes on. He also sees in the distance the dim light of four stars, the four cardinal virtues of classical and Christian ethics. We all know what they are. Prudence, or wisdom, we heard about this a little earlier, justice, fortitude, and Aristotelian and Ciceronian temperance. But they are too far and not quite visible in the daylight. The pilgrim can begin to take his orientation from them, situated as they are in the resurgent light of dawn over the desert landscape. But he cannot. Dante the pilgrim encounters, on the other hand, a solitary old man. An old man for figuring a new life? Yeah, Cato. He's a historical figure, Cato of Utica, who died a suicide in the civil war of Rome between Caesar and Pompey, as told in the late post-Virgilian epic called Pharsalia by the poet historian Lucan. He is Lucan has put an end to the life because the life of Cato, because he wanted to put in view the historical violence and tyrannical governments of the city of Florence. So what emerges then is the foundation of the hierarchy of values for a new order, which in fact will unfold as the backbone of Purgatorio's conceptual layout. Now, why does he put Cato on the scene? What does Dante make him a crucial figure at the ushering in and preparing with the site of Cato? Cato, who in his life on earth had been acknowledged as an upholder of moral reason, a jura dantem, one who gives the laws, a very fundamental notion in Roman culture. He's the custodian of rights, a guardian of Roman law. Now he watches over the laws regulating purgatory. And however, when he meets Dante and Virgil, the guide of Dante, coming approaching him down the slope, but near the water of the island, he asks them, "What are you doing here? Are the laws of the abyss in hell?" He screams at them, like Virgil and Dante, as if they were transgressing the boundaries of hell and purgatory. "Sono le leggi," you want to hear some Italian, "sono le leggi d'abisso, così rotte, che dannate venite alle mie grotte." Are the laws of the abyss so broken that damned as you must be, you really dare come to these caves? But Cato's law is not, at this point, the major value for the moral reconstruction of the world. Now, he thinks that maybe they are. Cato died a suicide for the love of political liberty and in the heroic belief that there are ideals worth dying for. That's why he's put where he is there in purgatory. That ideals such as liberty, the love of liberty, are worth dying for. Liberty is not in itself a virtue. Dante knows what the four virtues are, where the other virtues are. The whole of purgatory is organized around virtues and vices, a confrontation between them, humility and pride, and all the way down. Liberty is not in itself a virtue. It is, however, the condition for the practice of all other virtues. So you have now humility, you can choose the world of charity, and so on and so forth. Cato had reached the suicidal decision at a time when all other moral values in the world of Roman history had eroded, and the human reality in action at Pharsalia was only the passion for suicidal civil war. As Lucan puts it in his reevaluation of Roman history over and against the Virgilian mythology of the city, it's a little bit, the reference is a little bit too cryptic. I'm thinking of the fact that Lucan is a poet, a Spanish origin poet, who is writing after Virgil, and he uses Virgil as his counterfeit. Virgil writes the Aeneid, which is the extraordinary celebration of the origins and the great future of Rome. It didn't come to pass because the Republic ceded to the Empire and the Emperor, Augustus, Pompey, and so on, and the two of them are involved in a constant battle for who should be first and who should be the sole emperor. So there is this kind of look and opposite, the reevaluation of Roman history over and against the Virgilian mythology, the optimistic mythology of the city. It was the never-ending contest. Actually, this is Lucan who writes, I'm quoting from him, the Civil War. It was a never-ending contest between Caesar and freedom. So this was a battle that Lucan describes, Civil War, Book 6. Virgil, the guide, describes, Virgil, who is the guide to Dante, this is not the poet, describes for Cato's benefit Dante's own quest to sort of ingratiate him, since he was so angry when he first saw them. Now Virgil addresses Cato, Dante is like you. He was involved in a quest for liberty as you were. Libertà va cercando, come sa, che si cara, come sa, chi per lei vita rifiuta. He is looking for liberty, as he knows he, who you, Cato, who has given up his life for the love of liberty. He adds, tu sai che non ti fu per lei amara in utica la morte, ove ha lasciato la veste che al grandì sarà si cara. Purgatorio 1, line 70-75. As you know, you who in Utica, Africa, you looked for death and you shed the gown that on the day of the resurrection would be so clear for you. It's part of a rhetorical move to once again to calm down Cato. Part of the text at this point centers on liberty as a possible foundation of to be reclaimed. In a subtle polemic, actually, Dante frames the celebration of liberty in the ambiguous light of its logical and psychological limits. Liberty, so Cato has it in the canto, is conditioned by laws and their possible transgression. There's no clear idea of what this liberty is. For the time being, Dante focuses on everything that violates the principle of liberty. Secondly, Dante focuses on the intrusion of the tyranny of the past in Cato's mind. He seems to have been for in favor of liberty, but he has now the wonder if he is nostalgic for his wife, Marcia, evoked by Virgil's solicitation. Let us go through, he says. He says, ask Cato, even if it's a violation, let us go through. Don't worry about the laws of this place. Do it for the love of Marcia, so that when I go back to Limbo, which is where he is, and she's a neighbor of mine, I can praise him. I can praise you to her. Cato, however, rejects the solicitation. He is he's free of Marcia and the past. So this is, because freedom also, that's the implication of Dante, is a virtue for him of the future. It cannot, freedom is a condition for the future. It cannot be looked at as something that belongs to the past. Dante's representation, in short, conveys his insight into the fragility of liberty. It's a worthy ideal, but it's fragile because the psychology of the free man cannot be fathomed, for instance, because there are always transgressions and lawlessness impinging on them. And it's a condition forever liable to transgressions. But there is more to it. Dante is expressing, actually, at this point, his departure from St. Augustine's reflection on the nature and dubious of authority of political values, such as liberty, which led him to reject altogether Cato as a significant Roman hero. Let me tell you how. So in other words, this is already Cato. Is an important figure there, but it's also the point of the polemical division between Dante and Augustine, and you will see the consequences of it. In the City of God, Book 1, 26, in a context in which he discusses whether or not Christians have, quote, any authority for committing suicide, as Cato did, in any circumstances, whatever, Augustine appeals to the principles of the biblical law. Thou shalt not kill, nor even yourself, he adds. And he dismisses Cato as a suicide who threw himself because he actually was unable. That's the truth behind Cato. He was unable, so he claims, to endure Caesar's victory. Let me just read the passage to you so that this is Augustine. Besides Lucretia, he goes on through all the heroines whose suicides have been manipulated by Roman historiography. Besides Lucretia, who was made to be the virtuous woman who died herself out of the horror of being violated by the son of the king, Tarquin the Proud, was an episode that brought the whole Roman monarchy, the seven kings, to an end. So this is now his concerns about, Augustine's concerns about Lucretia and the whole notion of a suicide, and therefore his own oblique polemic with Dante. Besides Lucretia, of whom enough has been said, our advocates of suicide have difficulty in finding any other prescriptive example, unless it be that of Cato, who killed himself at Utica. This is clearly the source book of Dante's representation of Cato. His example is appealed to not because he was only a man who did so, but because he was so esteemed as a learned and excellent man, that it could plausibly be maintained that what he did was, and is, a good thing to do. But of this action of his, what can I say? But that his own friends, enlightened men as he, prudently dissuaded him, and therefore judged his act to be that of a feeble rather than a strong spirit. Completely opposite view of Cato from Dante's. But by weaknesses shrinking from hardships, indeed Cato condemns himself by the advice he gave to his dearly loved son, for it was a disgrace to live under Caesar's rule, and that Cato was inviting, was convincing his son to commit suicide too. And Augustine finds this horrifying, and unbearable, by encouraging him to trust absolutely for Caesar's generosity. Why did he not persuade him to die along with himself? Cato then cannot have deemed it to be shameful to live under Caesar's rule. The truth is that his son, who he both hoped and desired would be spared by Caesar, was not more loved by him than Caesar was envied the glory of pardoning him. But the question of liberty, let me just put now this relationship between Augustine and Dante on about the question of suicide aside, and just say that throughout Purgatory, the question of liberty does not just appear at this beginning of Canto 1, but it plays a thematic role. It becomes a sort of motif which Dante deploys and defines throughout. And I want to give you some examples of Dante's concern with liberty. Let me give you some instances of this occurrence. In Purgatorio 16, the pilgrim meets one Marco Lombardi and asks him the questions about themes such as predestination, the origin of evil, where the cause of evil lies in the influence of the stars. Marco's response follows the argument of St. Thomas Aquinas, Summa Secunda Secunda, question 95, article 5, and rejects the principle of predestination. That has nothing to do with liberty and freedom. And along with predestination, any such an idea, determination, heredity, and whatnot, and asserts that the celestial bodies cannot by themselves be the cause of the work of these works of being free. The light of reason, says Marco, is given to human beings. Lume vi è dato a bene e a malizia. A light, an inner light, has been given to you for do the good or do malice. And even if it's hard to fight in the early battles of temptation, then you can go on and find the good by hanging on to it. The defense of the freedom of the will, this is already here, stands in acknowledgement of the title role free will plays in Dante's theory of love. And this is another occurrence of what liberty is for Dante. The lines are in Purgatorio 17, the central canto of the poem, Ne Creator, these are the central lines, tercets of the Divine Comedy, in Italian first. Ne Creator, ne creatura mai cominciò il figlio fu senza amore, o naturale o d'animo. Let me just read this in English. Some, it seems, when hurt, then some will bear such a grudge that they crave only the exact revenge. This triformed love is wept for down below. But I would have you understand the next which runs in broken order after God. We all confusedly conceive a good, desiring that our hearts may rest in that, and each will strive to make their way to it. If love is slack in drawing you to view or win that good, then this ledge where we are now, after your fit repentance, martyrs you, and that a good will, and so on and so forth. So it's really becomes a central theme, this idea that there are two types of love, one of natural love and one of choice, one of freedom. The natural impulse can never really be sinful. Naturally coming up from a person, but that which is really crucial is the so-called the choice that we make, and we can make mistakes by choosing the wrong objects, not loving enough, or loving too much. So there is a kind of liberty as a mode of entertaining and opening up the kind of awareness of every activities of ours. In Dante's Universe of Love, in brief, which love is the seed of every virtue, the choice is not to the product of love itself. It's the product of rational judgment. Finally, Virgil's artistic role in the poem comes to a close. And that's the last example that I'll give about freedom and the importance of freedom. In Purgatorio 27, which are really almost at the point, Dante is at the edge of the Garden of Eden. He's returning to the purity of the garden, the Prelapsarian garden, when he finally, and he gets, and Virgil at this point will crown the pilgrim. He has reached, so he tells the disciple, the point where libero, dritto e sano e tu arbitrio. Now finally you have the free will. You have returned and you are on your own. You can sit or go. You can make your own decisions. This is the extraordinary power, I think, of Dante's moral sense, to always believe that he's dealing with grown-ups, not with children. Grown-ups who are capable of taking responsibilities for what they do. This is the faculty, in other words, that he has here, free will. It is the faculty. This is the implication where free will is acknowledged as the faculty capable of sitting, of the pilgrims, of sealing the pilgrims' moral autonomy. But Dante, to go back now to the relationship to Dante and Augustine, on about the Cato, Dante heeds, in effect, I read the passage, Augustine's rejection of Cato's assertion of political moral freedom from the standpoint of his theology of liberty. To say it differently, in the different interpretation of Cato by Augustine and Dante, we witness the clash between a theological reading of liberty by Augustine and the political philosophy that Dante at this point is giving of Cato. To Cato, Augustine opposes the saintly John, who endured dreadful evils in his body rather than deliver himself from all torments of self-inflicted death. His judgment is clear in terms of Augustine's rejection of Cato's political moral freedom from the standpoint of the universality of his theology of liberty. Though he dissents, Dante heeds the lesson and the warning contained in the City of God. So Dante doesn't agree with Augustine about, but then he seems to have rethink his position. In the economy of the text, the question of liberty is given also a theological twist, which is to say that Dante enters the conceptual world of Augustine, finally. Let me tell you how he does it. The pilgrim and his guide, somewhat disoriented, are walking along the shore of the island of Purgatory, where all of a sudden a boat arrives carrying a new load of souls in the journey of redemption. They sing in exitu, Israel de Egipto, Purgatorio 1, line 43, which is a line, as most of you I'm sure know, comes from Psalm 131, which is in my edition, which is a lyrical reflection on, and which recounts the Jewish experience away from the house of bondage, away from slavery in Egypt, through the wilderness to the promised land. In other words, Dante now goes on quoting, this is Purgatorio, after seeing Cato, an episode of religious history, the freedom of the Jews in abandoning Egypt and moving on to the promised land. Such a reference to Exodus constitutes the underlying narrative structure of the Divine Comedy, as my teacher, some 40 years ago, Charles Singleton had argued. Dante, in short, broadens the issue of freedom from a Roman political social dimension to a theological understanding of historical events. There is a distinction between Dante's two representations of liberty. In the case of Cato, we see at work the individual knowledge of the freedom of self, knowledge and the assertion of the ethical philosophy rooted in the freedom of the will. The event of Exodus, on the other hand, describes the experience of a community of shared cultural origins, together, taken together, as according to the complementary in a twist, complementary by traditions, caste freedom as a historical principle of values. The essence of Augustine's recognition of grace, that's what he calls it. Augustine calls it, Augustine refers to this grace, by which he faces liberty as a completely new, radical rejection of the forms of naturalism. And it develops it in the form of liberty, linking God's mercy and the human willingness to receive grace as a gift and as a privilege, whereby the relationship between man and the divine, freedom and grace, is not one of slavery. The text is called De Correptione et Gratia, not a text that I think many Augustinians that I have known have read. It's about correction and grace. And it's really an extraordinary text, and I'm alluding here only to some superficial aspects of it. Nonetheless, it's a polemic against naturalism. The real threat to the notion of liberty and to the notion of grace is naturalism, the way human beings espouse the values of a nature that shapes us, that we want to follow, we want to be worthy of. The term, meanwhile here, the term of deployed in Paradiso 2 or 3, the term grace is used by Dante once in Paradiso now, not Purgatory, Paradiso 2, 3, as the poet acknowledges the limitations of his own narrative. And he says these great phrases, trasumanar, significar, per verbo non si poia. A cui l'esempio basta, a cui esperienza grazia serve. Paradiso 1, line 70, 73, I can translate this for you. To go beyond the human, he's entering now a dimension of existence which is beyond human beings. He's just seen the metamorphosis of a Greek myth, Glaucus. And he says, I too am going beyond now into the domain of the divine. But to going beyond the human cannot be signified, cannot be related through language. But let the example be sufficient. Once grace has given you the experience for it. The experience, Paradiso 1, line 70, 73. Passing beyond the human cannot be put into words. Let Glaucus, show you the example until grace grants you the experience of going beyond. Where are these lights? What is the meaning of grace at this point? For Augustine, we know grace is the form of God's freedom and the way God's freedom yields to us, forgives us, if we are ready to accept it. But grace is also that quality that implies that we cannot really accept naturalistic interpretations of history. We are not going to believe that we are selected, that we are worthy of heaven only because there is this kind of act of grace. Grace is really what replaces all other forms of Dante's understanding of the relationship between the divine and the human. It's grace. It's always God's grace that we can touch us. Let me say a little bit more, and then I'll try to come to a quick conclusion. These lines about grace and the example express Dante's moving away from the theory, never mind now naturalism, the theory of mimetic representation. You know, it's not I'm going beyond the human, then I can tell you exactly what I saw. No. It cannot be signified through words. So whatever comes from God has to be, it's an experience that you have to cherish, and it's your example that should do to convey the meaning of it all to other people. That's the difference. But why? Mimetic representation of a correspondence, you understand what I mean? A mimetic representation of a correspondence between words and reality. Dante says, no, that's not what I'm going to be doing in paradise. It's a work of grace. And grace, this is what makes grace better than anything else. Because grace is given equally to all. It has the aspect and the character of genuine universality. And it's so important as a form of freedom, because strangely, human beings can even reject it. So many people say, oh, grace, I don't talk to you. I don't know what grace is. I never get it. But that's all right, because we're really saying, I understand the freedom that grace is linked with. Grace is a universal touch of freedom. Correzione, grazia, I repeat. Now, the lines, passing beyond the human, cannot be put into words. The lines express. Dante's thinking about poetry now. The poetic, the freedom of a poet, if you wish, and the freedom of reading, and the freedom of readers. We're all involved in this activity of freedom. So these lines express Dante's moving away from the theory of mimetic representation, a kind of, that's what I saw, this, I tell you what I saw, of a correspondence between words and reality. The pilgrim poet experiences a trasubanar. He goes beyond the human, and the transition cannot be signified, cannot be translated into linguistic signs. The basic point of the tercet is clear. The split, we are witnessing the split, the distance, the separation between words and things, opening up a space for an esemplo, for an example, a poetic account that transcends literalism or the idea that we are imitating that which we see in the natural world. It conveys the insight that the example opens up the experience and makes it intelligible to us. In other words, take this, the examples of others, and apply it to yourselves. The slipperiness and uncertainty of this literal representation introduces the word of grazia here. But let grazia be the one that does it, grace. The source of the experience is grace. And grace stands behind the experience of a journey on the road to a new reality, to a new state. And yet it remains wrapped in strangeness and mystery. It can be apprehended as an example, as an esemplo, which is the literally bonded to a fact, but it illustrates the fact. Dante focuses on the symbolic structure of language, and this is really the whole point. Language, poetic language, has a symbolic structure. On the example, but as a symbol, such a symbolic, sacred language, whereby the relation one, and thereby he gives theology his aesthetical and hermeneutical clue. He says this is the way even language, even poetic language, belongs to this mode of it's an aesthetic a way of reading, but it's a way of guaranteeing freedom to us. And the reader will go on following his desire, that as such as grace will, as a gift of grace that will reach him. Thank you so much for your kind attention.
For questions, do you want to field them?
Okay. Oh, absolutely. It's a please.
Hi, Professor. You spoke about the two things, and I didn't quite understand the relationship of the two, which is you said that love is the seed of every virtue in Dante.
Yes.
And at the same time, that rational judgment is also the source, I think you said, a source of virtue. Oh,
it's a love that is enlightened by
it. Can you explain the relationship between love and rational judgment in that context?
Well, it's a love that is enlightened by, it's a passion enlightened by reason. Dante does not like split personalities, I'm afraid. There is, you know, we have will and reason. I'm going to go rethinking or repeating some of the things said a little earlier, beautifully said a little earlier. But we are a combination of the two. So there is love, which can be natural, and yet we have to make choices. And that implies the order of rationality. I have to be very clear in my mind about what I want, what I can do for others, how can I be joined with others. So I don't think it's, thank you for the question, but this is what, I don't know, I hope I clarified it. You know, it's a reason is part of the moral judgment that which we can make and we're expected to make of the realities that we encounter, the very idea of encounter. Dante is a poet of encounters, by the way. There are so many fantastic encounters between people who don't see each other. And the first thing they do is, which is a variant, a slight variant of what we call love, romantic love, which is, there he calls it amicizia. Yes. They have the same etymology, the same etymological root. So that is always the kind of, that's the openness that reason can guarantee, the kind of coming together.
Yeah, I think that just to clarify the question, I guess my question really is, to what extent does love enable rational judgment? Are you making an argument that somehow love is enriching or strengthening one's capacity for rational judgment?
Sure.
Or is there
a I have a surprise for you. You gotta go and read Dante's Vita Nuova, this little book, which was his first book, and it's all about that.
Which book?
The New Life, meaning youth. It's an autobiographical piece of his. It's the story of when he was 9 years old, he met a girl who was 9 years old, Beatrice. He didn't know that she didn't know her name, but she said, "I feel so good when I see her that she's the one who gives beatitude. Just look at her." She sees her 9 years later. She says, "I haven't forgotten her." So it's the story. Then she dies. This is the story of a sad love. And yet it's the, what is love and how is love? How does love belong to an order of reason, to an order of rationality, and not the eclipse of reason? That would be good. That wouldn't be a good love. Maybe that's what Dante says, yeah.
I might ask a question then. I know you've described the three canticles, Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradiso, as being about politics, ethics, and aesthetics, respectively.
Glory. Yes, it's light. The Paradiso is about the light. And therefore, it makes me see, and it's an object of vision. Gives us vision, and it's the object of vision. Yes, that's right.
So there's a sense in which, I mean, Thomas would say that we cannot love what we do not know, but Dante also draws out this other side that, and I think maybe this is what Thomas is getting at, is that also we only really know that which we already love.
Absolutely. That's really that. It's the old debate, very medieval, by the way, among philosophers. Must I know in order that I love, or must I love so that I may know? And of course, the positions between so-called voluntarists, those who claim that the will matters more than anything else, and the intellectuals. You know, I'm talking here to a crowd of Thomists, so you know what I'm talking about, who think that reason is really what causes that. I think that Dante is a way of being a little bit of both. You know, he has this fantastic representation of himself, hovering, as you know, as he goes up in order to, first of all, to go down, he has to go up into the inferno. And it's his left foot, which is... has sometimes gives him problems. So all Dante scholars say, why the left foot? Till they find out that it's the foot of the will. So the 2 feet, with 2 feet, because there are two aspects of the soul, the will and the intellect. So he was wounded in his will, which means that he actually was a Thomist. Huh? That's very good. Please.
Actually, you spoke a little bit. I think the way you described it is that the future appears to be the locus of freedom. And you also refer, especially in the case of Cato, to how the past could be a bit tyrannical, or it could change
Well,
and I'm thinking back to the previous talk by Father James on Aquinas and the role of memory in prudential life and in prudence. And how do you see Dante transfigure, as opposed to the negative inflection, the negative possibilities of memory in his poem, into maybe something that can propel one toward
the future? Well, The memory for the memory is crucial. I mean, it's almost an Augustinian idea. You cannot, there's no knowledge without memory. You know, these are statements that reverberate constantly throughout the confessions. Memory is the fundamental part in Augustine for knowledge. For Dante, it's true. There is a memory. First of all, if you live in memory, and he does. I mean, the whole Vita Nuova, New Life. You have read it. We have read it. You know, it's really a poem which begins with a celebration of memory. It begins with in that part of the book of memory. Memory is a book where few things appear and so on. And then by the end, Dante gives away, completely gives up the idea of memory, and he says, "I hope to be able to say of her," because he sees Beatrice in a vision sitting at the foot of God's majesty, God's throne. And so he says, "I have to write something about her, worthy of her. So I hope to be able to say things of her that never has been said of any other woman." The hope. You know, everybody who studied a little bit of Latin remembers that there are three verbs: hope, promito, e juro. Always take the future. They would tell us. They would teach us when I was in middle school. So it's really, it gives up memory and turns to the future. Dante is a poet of the future. He is called so many things, but he is the poet who is always looking at the future. And I announce to you that my next book on Dante, which is the final thing that I write, the last chapter is that theology of the future. Even in theological issues, he goes on thinking about not necessarily what the tradition has preserved, which he of course knows and so on, but how can we open up to the demands of the present and the future. Yeah, Dante is definitely a poet of the future and understands that one problem with memory is that it makes us live in the world of the pure imagination. It changes the past into phantoms. You see what I mean? And that's really to him not quite. He has too solid a sense of reality to believe in that and hold on to that. Yeah, but that's, you know, I have given you four or five cases where memory is dangerous. There's always a nostalgia. There's always a way of making us look back. He wants us to look ahead. And actually, I had a chance of saying this about a beautiful book, a manuscript that I read. I said, well, this is a book that makes us look back so that we can be ready to move forward. So this, and that's really Dante, by the way. That's to me Dante's poetry, Dante's thought. How many of you have read The Divine Comedy? Oh my, oh, I'm overwhelmed. Oh my. Well, I knew you intended. But do look at this Decorruzione et Grazia. I would like some of you that, but you know, in Latin. Actually, I'm reading a Latin. I happen to have all the works of St. Augustine in Latin by a Spanish publisher. And they have included Spanish translations. And when I see a passage that I have to go and rush for a dictionary, I read the Spanish. And but you should really look at that. It's a fantastic book. Really, the Corruzione e Grazia, a gutsy work, very gutsy work, a critique of all forms of what he calls naturalism. The person who knew it well, by the way, was Spinoza. But I won't go into that. Please don't let me go into that. What do I know of Spinoza?
Can I just ask a question? You said many of these things during your talk, but could you just maybe draw them together in one brief explanation about the theme of freedom in Dante? You spoke about
this kind of civic freedom or political freedom. I mean, you made some references to freedom more on the, in the spiritual sense of freedom, and maybe what you see in the Inferno or in Purgatorio and in Paradiso, you see freedom. Could you just sort of summarize your conclusions about that?
Well, the trajectory of my argument goes from the questions of liberty and freedom in Purgatory begins. Purgatory begins with the recollection of a secular, political, Roman idea of liberty. That's which has a kind of almost hallowed aspect. The of Cato, who dies for to protect liberty, because he knew that neither Pompey nor Augustus would be willing to make up. So rather he wants to draw attention, their attention. Look, I would rather die than live under your tyranny. That was the point. That was one thing. And then I moved on to the point of giving a lot of examples about all these forms of freedom. And then I just see that he employs a kind of, you know, very significant, whenever a word appears only once in a poem, that should alert you, you know, what's going on here. And mentions the concept, the idea of grace. A grace at a point of writing. The grace of writing that sort of supplies the possibility of literalizing the experience, you know, the refusal of having, you know, I cannot go on recounting to you literally what has happened, as if this were just a physical reality that I can go on describing to you. We are dealing with pure spirituality. The world of grace is the world of God's gift, which makes all of us free to read and to write and realize and live in that space, in that of the broken world of words and things, and try to pull together and make sense of them. The whole point is that Dante is a poet who has been thinking very seriously about the questions of political implications and delusions of freedom, the manipulations that, for instance, Augustine points out. He already had done the same thing for Lucretia, the death of Lucretia, the horror of the Roman Empire and the kings, who went home thinking of the death of she commits suicide out of shame for being having been violated by, I indicated all of that. It's just, why did she kill herself? That's the question that Augustine asks. If she was so pure that she was for violence was all against her, why did she have to die? Why did she have to die? This was a political manipulation, because the transition, he adds, because the transition from the world of monarchy to the world of republic needed the heroine, needed the kind of sacrificial victim, and that's how she became one. This is exactly the kind of situation that he says happens with even Cato and so on. So there is a fascination with the political implications of liberty, the inevitability of all of that, and yet the idea that it can become very dangerous, that the only way we have to turn to is grace, understood in terms that I have just described, which I can repeat, but I don't want to bore you. But you know what I mean. Grace is so. There is a that you, he never has these objections about grace. Grace is actually the real answer against those who believe in a kind of that we are predestined, that it doesn't matter what we are doing, that we are predestined, we are selected, we are. No. This is the universality of God's. Freedom, that God is creation was a work of freedom, and God works, lives in that within the freedom of His own creation. That universality is best presented by grace and its implications. We are dealing with spiritual values now with Him, and Dante accepts it. So I will never read the Divine Comedy as a political text. That's really what it means, and I won't. Okay. Yes.
His political fidelity of Cato Utica really drove him to self-destruction.
But I remember seeing in a seminar directed to his freshman year that Pedro Biderkopf was discussed as a figure that embodied the possibility of pressing the will and of reform to the empire. So I'm curious just to hear your thoughts. How is Cato's position as a figure who takes his own life in order to be very true to his political ideals, how does that possibly still represent a possibility of reform and improvement in both the will and political enterprise of empire?
You are touching exactly the kind of suspicions that St. Augustine entertained and he writes about. Augustine wonders, rather than talking about Cato's own suicide, to bring some kind of rationality, some kind of reasonableness to the two figures of Caesar, the Civil War, and put an end to the Civil War. He did not want to take sides, one or the other, because that would have been a way of perpetuating the horror of the Civil War. So he goes on, therefore, thinking about annihilating himself. Augustine doesn't like that. Dante begins by liking it. I'm not saying that he's rejecting the political reading of the Court, but clearly there's a new hierarchy, something much more important is happening, and it's really his sense of the theology.
Professor, you mentioned earlier Purgatorio 16, where Lombardi speaks, and when Lombardi speaks, he mentions sort of this image of a child, and I was just wondering if you could maybe speak more about how play or childlikeness could be related to freedom, since he does also discuss about freedom essay.
Well, he's speaking about, well, he's actually giving the whole answer there about the whole question of what is the future here. I think this is the context. Are we driven, in our knowledge, are we really driven by, that's the question he's asked him. First of all, does all our knowledge come from the stars or not? He says, no. This is that is our knowledge and all of these arguments that are presented, are we predestined in doing what we are doing? No. That's clearly for him. And he treats them very nicely because he doesn't say no, it's father here and I do, because we almost seem to be willing to go at it, yeah? I say, yeah, let's scream it together. But that's the question. Then becomes the real issue. Then for Marco Lombardo is, no, the virtues begin within yourselves. That's it. The virtues are within yourself. You have to really make sure that it will flower outside of you. That's the case. Thank you. Grazie.